From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. There are crooks, criminals, and hucksters out there trying to get your money through investment scams, retail fraud, identity theft, and they've been there since commerce began. But are there degrees of hucksterism? And what's the line between an enthusiastic entrepreneur with a brilliant, albeit untested idea, versus a good old-fashioned snake oil salesman who doesn't really care if what's in the bottle he's selling doesn't work? His goal, to make the sale and move on. And how has the regulatory environment in the U.S. changed over the course of American history? And does it actually impact the sheer scope of fraud going on in America? Today, we're going to explore these questions with Edward Ballison, Vice Provost for Interdisciplinary Studies and Professor of History at Duke University. He's also the author of Fraud and American History from Barnum to Madoff, a book published in January by Princeton University Press. Edward Ballison, welcome to Coastline.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have a question about fraud or how to spot the signs of an out-and-out scam? Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Edward Ballison, do we have more or less regulation in 2017 than we did in 1917? And are there more or fewer scams today than there were 100 years ago?
So the first question's easier to answer than the second, simply because we don't have a census of fraud.
Yes.
And in fact, one of the interesting things about business fraud is that often people don't report it because of embarrassment. Or because they may have been implicating themselves in some nefarious endeavor by getting involved. So I would say there's no question that we have a much richer array of rules and regulations at every level of government, local, state, and certainly federal, than we did in 1917. It's not as clear to me that we have had a growth in this arena. If the comparison point was 1977 as opposed to 1917. And that would be particularly the case if you were focusing not just on law on the books, the statutes or administrative rules that have been put in place, but questions about the orientation of people running regulatory agencies or the kinds of budgets that are going to regulatory enforcement.
And when we look at the current era juxtaposed against, say, a couple of hundred years ago, I mean, your book really begins with the 19th century. Mm. The kinds of fraud we have, there's also been a richness in terms of the evolution of the ways that people can perpetrate fraud. And we've seen that from corporations down to individuals stealing identities today on the internet.
I think that's absolutely the case, and there's an interesting way in which I see business fraud as clustering around areas of economic innovation. So there's a tendency of the most innovative scammers to focus on the economic vistas that are just opening up, because of course one of the hallmarks of fraud is that it depends on a gap of information between counterparties in the marketplace, and that gap is usually greatest in economic contexts where people are just trying things out and the rules of the road are not well set.
Can you give us an example of that? Because you also cite economist Paul Krugman in your book, and he talks about springtime for charlatans.
Yes,
which I thought was a great reference.
So I'll give you an example from the late 19th century: the rise of mail order commerce, a precursor to what we would now all think about in terms of online commerce, where actually the dynamics are quite similar. So with mail order commerce, it's opened up by more efficient mail service and also the creation of subsidized postal rates. making it cheap to move not just letters but goods through the mail. And as soon as the economics of this become clear to people, there are firms that sought to take advantage of this opportunity to widen their potential market by selling not just locally but to consumers much further away who could gain access to their wares through the auspices of the mail.
Now that sounds like good business to me.
It was great business. But it also massively complicated the question of getting to know the firm with whom you were dealing. So if there's this great deal that's being offered through newspaper advertisement or some circular that's gone out through the post, how do you know you can trust it? Almost immediately, in some instances, even ahead of the reputable businesses, were firms that were more than happy to take your money and run. So the same dynamic actually then occurred in the 1990s and 2000s with online commerce. Very, very easy to pretend to be something that you're not.
So when there's some sort of transformative thing happening in the economy and the way we do business, that's when we create this confusion among the public and it makes it harder for them to determine what's real and what isn't.
I think that's right. And, there's a way in which fraud is always changing because of the new economic possibilities that are emerging, either because of technological innovation or because somebody's come up with a new way of organizing a business or has thought up some entirely new kind of good or service. As all those things change, the kinds of fraudulent pitches that really work change with them. And yet at the same time, as far as I can tell, fraud doesn't, in another sense, change that much at all. So the basic nature of a pump and dump investment scheme or a bait and switch marketing effort is more or less the same now as it was in the early 19th century.
That's really striking in your book. We're talking with Edward Ballison of Duke University. He's the author of Fraud in American History, from Barnum to Madoff. And it's just so striking that you pull out four categories of fraud opportunity in your book. Investment opportunities, goods retailing, marketing of personal economic opportunities, and then managerial looting of companies, and how the basic principles don't really seem to change and how that fraud is perpetrated. But you mentioned mail order fraud and how with the rise of the Postal Service, of course, there was a corresponding rise in fraud. Sears Roebuck was a part of that landscape. And that's a company that many people think of, especially in the mid-20th century, as, you know, the standard for business integrity. But how did that start?
So Sears Roebuck is a really interesting case. And you're right. In the mid-20th century, it was just a mainstay of American capitalism, the most respectable firm you could ever imagine. And to the extent that people have a clear sense of Sears today, they think in terms of department stores. But that's not where Sears had its start. It had its start as a mail order firm. And the challenge it confronted had lots of challenges. It had to get noticed. And this is true for almost all startups. They have to get noticed. And that puts a premium on promotion, which can easily slide over into hucksterism. So Sears offered all kinds of special deals, huge discounts, prizes. If you were the first person in West Virginia, or even the first 10 people in West Virginia who would buy a piano,
That hucksterism?
It was ballyhoo.
It was
ballyhoo.
It wasn't real.
Well, it depends. So it's just a mixed up bundle of stuff, Sears in the early years. So he was.
Did they ever give away a piano?
Oh, they did, absolutely. But there were also lots of circumstances in which they would say that they would be able to sell you a gun or a doll for a couple of cents.
Right.
And it was only if you read the fine print that you realized that it was a tiny little miniature toy.
Well, you talk about a sofa and a set of chairs being advertised by Sears for 95 cents, And of course, that's appealing. Even back then, I guess 95 cents wouldn't have been very much for living room furniture. And then people get it in the mail and it's doll sized.
Exactly. Exactly. But there were lots of other features of their business that that raised questions about their practices. So some of this was just a function of how quickly the firm grew. It tapped huge demand in the American countryside for consumer goods of all kinds, and often they couldn't meet the demand in the early decade, particularly the first decade of the firm. And so they would just substitute whatever they could find. What to make of that? So you say you're going to sell somebody one thing, you send something else. From the company's perspective, they had lots of indications that many of their consumers were perfectly happy with what they got. It was better, much better quality, and much, in some cases not even available than what was available locally.
But this was also kind of the beginning of the Postmaster General getting involved in policing some of these businesses.
That's right. And so Sears, what's really interesting about Sears in these early years is how it's on the margin of respectability. And it, on the one hand, has lots of bankers who can vouch for the company and manufacturers, the suppliers who can speak on its behalf. And yet there are also lots of disgruntled customers who raise concerns that gets the post office involved.
And so we'll hear more about how the post office got involved when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking today with Edward Ballison of Duke University. He's the author of the book Fraud: An American History from Barnum to Madoff. And we're taking your questions on this Thursday. Do you have a question about consumer protections, education, or fraud throughout this country's history? You can call us during the Live Thursday show at 910-343-1138. You can also email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today about the history of fraud in America through investment scams, retail scams, offers of economic opportunity, and managerial misbehavior. We have the quintessential expert on fraud with us today. Edward Ballison is Vice Provost for Interdisciplinary Studies and a professor of history at Duke University. He's also the author of Fraud: An American History from Barnum to Madoff, published in January by Princeton University Press. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Edward Ballison, just before we went to break, we were talking about the rise of Sears Roebuck and how some of its growing pains contributed, and also how the growth of the Postal Service helped expand Sears Roebuck but created potentialities there for a little bit of hucksterism, sort of blurring that line between business integrity and maybe taking some liberties. But then at some point, the Postal Service stepped in as a form of policing force of sorts.
No, that's right. And it occurs actually. So Sears Roebuck started in the late 1880s, and its first decade was mostly the 1890s. The postal system for policing fraud emerged actually about 15, 20 years before that. And it emerged out of concerns related to the deception and outright fraud going on within mail order commerce. In many respects, the initial move into this arena reflected just self-protection by the post office, because what many firms would do, the more disreputable ones, and these were fly-by-night firms that were nothing like Sears Roebuck, they would just take orders and then they wouldn't deliver. And then when there were complaints that would come in, they would just blame it on the post office.
And would consumers have any recourse through the post office, or was this just a bad PR problem for the post office?
Well, it was mostly a bad PR problem, and so in 1871, there's a reform of the postal laws, and it includes new powers for the post office in two ways. First, they get a confirmation from Congress that they have the power to deny access to the mails to individuals who are engaging in fraud. And that then results in the creation of the fraud order, which the Postmaster General could issue against any firm or individual, which would keep them from sending or receiving mail. And then the second power they received was to go after people for a new crime, mail fraud, to actually prosecute people criminally through the federal courts.
And Sears Roebuck is an interesting case because they were an actual business, and sometimes maybe they blurred this line. But then you talked about other firms that were just out-and-out scams.
That's right. And so with Sears Roebuck, one of the reasons that the post office initially got really interested in them is simply because they were offering these prizes to the first number of people who might buy something. And the problem here was not, from the post office's point of view, that Sears wasn't delivering on this. It was that this was essentially a lottery and violated their sense of moral rectitude, that a lottery by definition was fraudulent, because who could really tell? It was just a way to get people's business through this promise of a chance of getting something extra. In other cases, there are firms that are engaging in stock promotion through the mails, promoting really dodgy companies. Firms that were engaging in complete bait and switch tactics, and so there's a mix of the sorts of businesses that they went after.
And this took some development, because the Postal Service could determine that a company was committing mail fraud or could be in the process of investigating a company, and the company would have no idea. I mean, there wasn't actually.
That's right. So this was actually quite a substantial jump from what had been the legal baseline before the implementation of this new federal law. In most cases in the 19th century, the legal baseline was caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. And the thought was, well, if you're going to engage, for example, in mail order commerce and you get burned, well, then you'll learn from it. And you'll presumably do a better job of investigation next time. So once the post office really began exerting a lot of authority in this arena, it wasn't long before a lot of people started complaining about their tactics. So the postal inspectors who were engaging in this type of regulation, they weren't providing people with any notice in the first number of years.
The accused.
They weren't giving them a hearing. If a postal inspector decided that somebody deserved to be cut off, they were just cut off. And this led to really quite vociferous complaints about the lack of due process associated with this tactic. I would say as well that the resulting reforms that emerged made the system fairer, but it also made it harder to cut people out of access to the mails.
Because the evidentiary burden rises.
And that's right. And you get lawyers involved, and there have to be hearings, and there's delay. And this is one of the crucial things about dealing with business fraud of this type, especially consumer fraud or investment fraud. Ideally, you want to cut it off as quickly as possible to limit the harms to investors or consumers.
Before we leave the 19th century, let's talk about P.T. Barnum, because there seem to be two pictures of this man. One is that he was just a flamboyant, fabulous entertainer and maybe a little bit of a huckster, but charming, and the value of the entertainment
right.
kind of made up for that. And then the other is that he was just an out-and-out scam artist. Which was he, and why did he charm so many people?
So as an entertainer, as a person who developed the American Museum in New York City and then also took his acts on the road in various modes and mechanisms, eventually culminating in a circus, which actually just after it merged became Barnum & Bailey, and that actually just had its last show just a couple of months ago, actually.
Yes, that's right.
Barnum was the consummate showman, in many ways the father of modern American entertainment, and very much the huckster. Did he engage in fraud? Well, in his role as an entertainer, there were all kinds of fakery in what he was doing. But I think he would have argued at the time, and did so often in print, that people knew what they were getting when they came to his shows, and the fact they were coming precisely to try and figure out how he was fooling them.
And can you give us an example of that? Because when you say, just when you say entertainment, I think that's, well, it's entertainment. It's about the sleight of hand, or about, you know, the perpetrating the illusion.
So he would have exhibits, the Fiji mermaid, which was supposedly mummified example of a creature that had been captured off of Fiji and then preserved. And, you know, this was completely false. He had all kinds of fabulous exhibits. But he mixed that in with promotions of the most famous European opera singer of the time, Jenny Lind. You know, one of his first acts was supposedly a 160-year-old woman who had been George Washington's slave, Joyce Heth. And he marketed it this way in the 1850s.
So just then, from an ethical point of view, how is that different from today's reality television, which, as many people know, is not really reality?
I think there are lots of parallels. The interesting thing about Barnum is that one of the responses that he offered in the face of growing public criticism, especially from evangelical conservatives of the time, was to say, no, I'm not fraudulent. I'm going to tell you who the real fraudulent people are. And so he writes a book in 1864 called Humbugs of the World, which is this massive tome, this catalog of all the different scams and frauds that you could find in American commerce, religion, politics.
Is it a reliable source? Or did he make a lot of it up?
No, it's a pretty reliable source, actually. And so partly what he was engaged in here is a process of what I refer to in the book as deflection. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways you convince people that you're on the up and up is that you really spend some time pointing the finger elsewhere. Now, did Barnum ever engage in outright fraud? I think at least once he actually went through a financial insolvency in the mid-1850s. And there's pretty good evidence that he secreted assets in the aftermath of that failure and put them in his wife's name. So that's bankruptcy fraud,
right?
Pure and simple.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration today of American fraud, regulatory practices, and consumer education. Our guest today is Edward Ballison. He's Vice Provost for Interdisciplinary Studies at Duke University, where he's also a professor of history. And he is the author of Fraud and American History from Barnum to Madoff. You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. When we talk about the ethics of the day, especially when we're looking at the 19th century, there was a guy by the name of Anthony Comstock who started as a salesman himself.
Mm.
And he founded the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. Tell us about that.
Well, Comstock was concerned about the impact of industrialization and urbanization and what it was doing to American society, culture. And culture in the 19th century, and particularly concerned about people like himself who had moved from rural towns or farmsteads to big cities looking for work or avenues of advancement, and who were being enticed by all kinds of dangers in the metropolis, whether that was drink or women or any of the other threats to the moral equilibrium of America as he understood it. And so that the society that he created with the help of wealthy merchants in New York City, and then this model then spread to most other large American cities quite quickly, was to create a group of people who would fight against abortion, prostitution, pornography, alcohol consumption, a whole panoply of social ills as they saw them. And the link for my story about the history of American business fraud is that he was equally concerned about lotteries and fraudulent businesses as well. So as mail order commerce picks up, Comstock quickly realizes that New York is a capital for all kinds of businesses, and that if they can get some influence over the policy with respect to the U.S. mails, that they can have an impact on all of these different issues, because people are ordering abortifacients through the mail, they're ordering pornography through the mail, they're arranging prostitution through the mail.
In the 1800s,
and so he gets. He gets the idea that he can become a postal inspector. And in fact, his pitch to the post office is, you only have to pay me $1 a year. This society that I've created for the prevention of vice will pay my salary. And he gets the gig and spends the next several decades fighting all of these things as a postal inspector.
Were there later efforts on the part of postal officials to educate consumers, you know, work on the other end of work on the demand end rather than the supply end?
Yes, but that work has been carried on far more substantially over the decades by particularly before the 1950s, 1960s, by non-governmental organizations and by journalists. So you get the emergence of entities like the Better Business Bureaus in the 19-teens, who invest enormously in public education. Before that, you've got newspapers and magazines in the 19th century, especially in this world that was more characterized by caveat emptor, putting a big focus on covering business fraud to educate their readers about the issue. So much so that many urban newspapers had a fraud beat. Many magazines had a fraud department, you know, where you could count day by day or week by week or month by month, depending on how frequently the publication appeared, that you could count on regular coverage of scams that were afoot, as well as general principles about how to protect yourself as an investor or consumer.
And back then, did consumer education help? Do you think it cut down on fraud, or not so much? Are the victims of fraud probably always going to be the victims?
So what's interesting is any compendium of business frauds is both a mechanism to protect yourself and a roadmap for potential deceivers. So it's a handbook for how to defraud as well as one for how to avoid being defrauded. I guess I'm inclined to answer this also partly by with reference to a lot of recent literature out of cognitive psychology, which suggests that we all have actually significant vulnerabilities to deception, and you know we may be able to educate ourselves, but I suspect that those listening to the program today, there are very few people out there who've never been taken in one way or another in the marketplace.
So you're saying that we're all vulnerable at some point to deception. Is there research on what makes our vulnerability ebb and flow? I mean, we know certain groups are more vulnerable, like seniors, for example.
Right.
And in the 1960s, when this country started to see a real climb in its elderly population, wasn't there a corresponding climb in the number of seniors who were targeted specifically for fraud?
And that has not gone away.
Right.
That's absolutely correct. And there's been a longstanding trend or a pattern, rather, of fraudulent businesses targeting new immigrants or targeting the poor, particularly for retail frauds, precisely because those groups tend to have less awareness about their economic circumstances and contexts And are often more vulnerable to imposition.
And I want to ask you more about that too, because you cite it was an early 1960s study about why the poor pay more. Mm. But when you're talking about not specific groups, but just generally all of us, and maybe those of us who are considered to be more aware and educated, when do we become vulnerable?
Well, what I would stress is that we're all, none of us are experts about everything. And so with respect to investment fraud, you know, there isn't much targeting of the poor there. There isn't much targeting of recent immigrants there. It can happen. In fact, Charles Ponzi focused on that in the early, late teens, or particularly early 1920s, before his pyramid scheme, investment scheme collapsed. But a great many investment frauds target professionals because they have resources, but they may not have much understanding of the financial markets. And so there's a variability to what we know about and what we're familiar with, and as a result, a variability to where we may have a particular propensity for being taken in.
And now tell us about this study in the early 1960s that looked at people who had less means and why they tended to pay more and be victims.
Well, part of it was a study of more market power and abuse than outright deception. Actually, probably more of that study focused on that issue. But what there was just a huge problem with access to stores and in particularly poor American cities. And that meant that individuals were highly dependent on just a small number of store owners who could take advantage of them.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking with the author of Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. Edward Ballison is also vice provost for interdisciplinary studies at Duke University and a professor of history. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your own question or comment. The number during this live Thursday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the history of fraud in America with Edward Ballison of Duke University. He's the author of Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Do you agree with President Trump that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be declawed, or does it deserve more support? We're going to get into some of those modern questions later in this segment. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Before we went to break, Edward Ballison, you were talking about that early 1960s study, why the poor pay more, and you were talking about problems with access to merchants being one of the factors. What are some of the other factors?
So the key thing is that if you're in a neighborhood and you want to buy furniture and you've got basically one option, you can't really you have a limited set of possibilities. Really, you can take that was on offer there or not. And many of the stores who had that market power sold on credit to make it more apparently affordable to individuals to buy their goods, whether electronics or furniture or whatever other durables they might be selling. And there were really abusive and deceptive practices associated with that type of commerce in a great many cases, with often the relationship being one where the customer would buy something on credit, and then the store would immediately sell the debt to a finance company or a third party who then could collect under the legal regime at that time, no matter what false promises had been made in the sale, in the marketing.
And of course, that person who has less means isn't going to have legal recourse, or
not going to have the resources to hire a lawyer. In many cases, that's right. So this was an endemic problem in urban America in the 1960s.
How does the modern idea of payday lending come into play when you're talking about people who prey on people with less money?
Well, so there are examples in which those types of loan arrangements are greased by deceptive promises of one kind or another. But often that domain tends to be one that people talk about more in terms of abuse of market power rather than fraud per se. So you know, if somebody is lured into a payday lending relationship with sort of false information about what the interest rate is or what the amount to pay will be or how long it will take to pay it back, then that would be a fraud case. And sometimes that does occur. It's more often just that people are being enticed or have no option other than to enter into relationships where they're paying massively high interest rates.
We have a question from Evelyn from Castle Hayne asks, how does Publishers Clearing House compare to the example given about Sears Roebuck?
So it's somewhat similar in the sense that, you know, there are fantastic promises and there's always an emphasis on the big winner whose life is made now fantastic by the award, the sweepstakes award. And yet there are regulatory rules and requirements that Publishers Clearing House has to uphold and live up to.
And didn't that change? I mean, didn't
that's
Publishers
a new thing. That's right.
Clearing
that's right.
House exist before some of those rules and then...
That's right. So they're going to be providing in the small print exactly what the likelihood is of winning. So then, you know, they're living up to disclosure of a kind. It's not really what's leading the message in the advertisement.
David from Wilmington says, we're currently living in a time of fraud due to currency manipulation. There's no real certainty about the value of money.
Well, this is an interesting question. It's hard to know, and it's partly a reflection of how complicated financial arrangements have become. So currencies are traded now with, you know, literally trillions of dollars of financial instruments and through computer algorithms that most people can't even begin to understand the basic premise of how these things work. And so we're dependent on the firms who are engaged in those types of activities adhering to basic rules and the assumption that the government regulators who interact with them are monitoring and keeping an eye on things.
And we know they are, right?
And they absolutely they are, and yet we also know that there have been instances not particularly with currency trading, but certainly with the setting of interest rates where large banks have engaged in collusive arrangements to basically, you know, cook those numbers. So the more you have those types of incidents, the more you can erode widespread public trust in the truthfulness of the underlying economic transactions.
When you look at just the American history of individual investors, was there a time in American history when there was a shift from generally wealthy people being investors in the stock market and then mainstream America kind of coming into that?
Absolutely. And the shift with respect to ownership of stocks and bonds really emerges in a most powerful way after World War I. So hundreds of thousands, millions of Americans bought Liberty bonds to help finance World War I. And then after the war, there was a very successful effort to get those people who had gotten a taste of investment to shift into corporate bonds or corporate stocks. In many ways, the marketing efforts pursued by investment banks at that time, though, were based on ideas that had been tested out by fraudulent promoters of stocks from the 1870s up through the 19-teens. So ideas like the mutual fund, where you could pool money and spread it in order to assure a higher return. That idea was first pushed by fraudulent stock promoters who promised that. They didn't do it. They just used that as a way to get money in. Or the stock picking fund that was going to take advantage of acumen and inside knowledge to make the best choices for where to put pooled money. Again, that was an idea that was out there in as early as the 1870s, but predominantly from firms that were marketing by mail and engaging in fly-by-night kinds of operations. But it eventually percolates into the financial mainstream.
And what's interesting, that was another really interesting parallel in your book, Fraud and American History, from Barnum to Madoff, written by Edward Ballison of Duke University. Just the idea of mutual funds in the 1800s, and then the fact that very recently people have started to look at the construct of mutual funds and say there's such a lack of transparency in terms of how these things operate.
Well, that's right. The concerns more recently have been much more about the kinds of fees associated with management of these funds, and some critiques that look at where funds put their put the resources entrusted to them. But as more and more Americans move to index funds, where it's not a choice for the manager really, and partly because that reduces the management fees, that's becoming arguably less of a problem in some respects.
If we're talking about modern times, in a nutshell, I realize this is a very involved story here, but
sure.
Bernie Madoff, how could he, with the Securities and Exchange Commission and all the regulatory requirements, all the oversight, there was a big shift with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, wasn't there, after the Great Depression into, hey, this needs to be much more regulated than it has been.
Oh, very much so. So yes, you have a big expansion of the regulatory apparatus around the financial markets and securities markets after the Great Depression and the New Deal, for sure.
So 1938?
Really, the Securities Act and Securities Exchange Act, that's 33 and 34, and then there are a steady stream of additional pieces of legislation and regulatory action subsequent to that.
And then decades later, we get Bernie Madoff. How could that happen when there were so many red flags along the way?
Several things. One is that Madoff had very carefully engaged with the regulatory apparatus. So in addition to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is charged with monitoring and enforcing the securities markets, a federal government agency, there's also the Financial Industry Regulatory Association, FINRA, which used to be the National Association of Securities Dealers, which is a companion self-regulatory organization. And Madoff was very heavily involved in FINRA. So he had enormous respect, a very high reputation, and it was just very difficult for people to believe that someone who was so well-connected and who had made a big show of sticking with the establishment and celebrating, for example, new kinds of protections for investors as they came out. It was very hard for people inside the regulatory framework to really envisage that he could be engaged in such a widespread Ponzi scheme.
Even with the returns that didn't make any sense.
There was just a disinclination to look too carefully until things really started falling apart. And that's also a function of what happened in those agencies to a certain extent during the Reagan years and the Bush 1 years, but even more so during Bush 2, and even to some extent actually during the Clinton administration, where there was a real turn back to trust in markets and a concern about excessive regulation as holding back the American economy. So in addition to cuts to budgets at the SEC, You also had just a different orientation at the top of that agency in the 2000s, much greater concern about sustaining America's role as a financial capital, and much more concern about making sure that access to capital was easy, rather than making sure that deception or deceit was not going on in the marketplace.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan had a somewhat public change of view when it came to regulation. And I'm not sure if you're asserting that he actually had different views publicly and privately, or if it actually shifted over the time.
I think it's really both. So he had a public view even while he was running the Federal Reserve, which was that fraud was actually one of the few problems that he thought government had a role to do something about, along with, say, controlling interest rates in the context of the financial system. But if you look at the decision-making that he made privately within the evidence that we have about it within the Federal Reserve, very opposed to coming up with new kinds of regulatory answers to brand new financial instruments like credit default swaps or collateralized debt obligations. Very disinclined to get in the way of those types of innovations. And it was only then after he was out of office and the full ramifications of the financial crisis became clear that he then said, "Oh, I think we should have paid a little more attention."
Dodd-Frank authorized the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that was actually, you write in the book that it was modeled on a 2007 idea put forth by Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. It's been, I mean, so that agency was actually created, but it was very tough to get the head of that bureau in place, approved. Mm-hmm. Why has that been such a push-pull? What's the political wrangling over?
Well, I think there are a number of different issues there. On the one hand, the CFPB has been, by many measures, extraordinarily effective. They've really done a fantastic job, arguably, of analyzing what's going on in the marketplace, of paying attention to the difference between community banks, say, and the really big players, of thinking creatively about how to improve not just consumer education, but also basic contractual defaults, so that when you're thinking about a car loan or a mortgage, potential borrowers have a better sense of what they're getting themselves into, and also trying to push firms into standard kinds of contracts that are clearer and less for consumers. They've also been pretty effective on the enforcement end, so that where there are clear abuses in the marketplace, clear deceptions, they've been pretty effective about holding people's feet to the fire. Where there's a concern, well, there are a whole series of concerns that have been raised by the Republican Party about the CFPB. Part of that involves the nature of this bureau. It's not subject to congressional appropriations, and it's not run by a commission structure of five or seven people with split between Republicans and Democrats. So there's that issue. But then they also see it as a violation of basic principles about the value of markets.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Edward Ballison, author of Fraud and American History, From Barnum to Madoff. What a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for having me.
Really enjoyed it. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. You can find it on the WHQR app and tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.